In 1916, St. Elmo Brady earned a doctorate in chemistry from the University of Illinois, the first African-American to do so. Today, the U of I is hoping to use lessons from his life to support more black scientists. Here's Lloyd Munjanja.
That story for me of St. Elmo Brady is a testament that we are supposed to be here in the Department of Chemistry. We're supposed to succeed and give back to our communities like what St. Elmo Brady did.
Plus, a new generation of evangelical Christians wants to move the needle on climate change action within their congregations, and the Rockford documentary Minding the Gap has been nominated for an Oscar. Director Bing Liu says the three young men featured are more complex than we usually see on film.
It's not just like good person, bad behavior. It's so tied into just the whole melange of feelings, the way that we make mistakes and grow. I mean, it's all part of it.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, Illinois filmmaker Bing Liu's Minding the Gap documentary has been nominated for an Oscar. We're going to revisit our conversation with him about the film. But first, in 1912, a grad student named St. Elmo Brady moved to Champaign-Urbana from the South. He was on a scholarship offered to him by the University of Illinois. 4 years later, he became the first African-American in the country to receive a doctorate in chemistry. And for decades after that, he helped mentor and support countless students, especially at historically black colleges. This Black History Month, St. Elmo Brady's life is being honored today at the University of Illinois. Jametris Rimkus is an archivist at the University of Illinois. Lloyd Munjanja is the Assistant Director of Graduate Diversity at the U of I's Chemistry Department, and they're both with me now in our studios in Urbana. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jametris, you've been learning more and more about St. Elmo Brady's life. First, can you tell us what his early life was? How did he end up getting a scholarship to the University of Illinois in 1912?
Well, so that's an interesting thing. Archivists, we work with a lot of paper and we dig through lots of boxes and we try to find this evidence. We also hope that the person was a great record keeper. St. Elmo Brady, unfortunately, was not the most fantastic record keeper out there. He, of course, completed high school. His mother was a former slave. She named him after a book. And his granddaughter theorizes that she named him after the book to prove that she was literate, because as we know, many slaves weren't literate.
And where was he from?
He was from Louisville, Kentucky.
And Lloyd, I'm sure that going to graduate school in 2019 is very different than 1912, but I imagine one thing that they have in common is that getting a PhD in chemistry is not an easy thing to do.
Right.
What does it involve? And I wonder how much we know about what it involved back then compared to now.
So when I look back in 1916 or so, we probably didn't have a lot of technology that makes our research a little more easier now. Some of the experiments we can now do in less than an hour now probably would be a thesis chapter then, so it would take a long time to do.
And when we think about the history, I wonder what we know about what his experience was like in Illinois. And I imagine just even moving from Kentucky to Illinois in 1912 was, I imagine, a very different experience.
It would have been a different experience. But at the same time, Champaign-Urbana was segregated as well. So at that time period, one of the most difficult things for all students was to find housing. And so the University of Illinois technically didn't provide housing to any student, but there were boarding houses in town that most students went to. However, those houses weren't open to African-American students. He most likely found housing through the local churches. The African-American community at that time was very tight-knit here, and so they helped each other. They usually put students up, fed them, made sure they went to church, made sure they went to classes. That's probably what life was like for him. The most difficult thing was housing. I imagine that he basically came here, kept his head down, did his work. He had a fiance to go back to. But the things he experienced were pretty typical of most African Americans at the time.
When we're thinking about his involvement, do we know, was he involved in any student organizations then, Jametris?
He became the first African American to join Phi Lambda Psi. It's the Chemical Honor Society that was founded at the University of Illinois. The first chapter was founded here, and he joined that chapter here. He was also inducted into Sigma Chi, which is another honor organization. And then recently, I found evidence in the Daily Illini. He helped at churches. And so those were kind of his activities.
And you mentioned he had a fiancée to go back to. What did he do after he got his degree?
The story is actually pretty sweet. He was at Tuskegee Institution, now Tuskegee University, teaching. He got the scholarship. His wife's name was Myrtle. He told his granddaughter that she was so beautiful that he was scared somebody would take her. So he proposed to her and left to come here and get his master's degree. His scholarship was for a master's degree. He completed his master's and then he did his PhD. And apparently, almost immediately after he got his PhD, he left and he met her in Colorado where she was from and married her immediately for fear that she was going to be snapped up by somebody else.
Well, she waited 4 years.
Yeah, she waited for him. And she was teaching English at Tuskegee at the time when they met.
And so I understand throughout his academic career, I don't know if he knew he was the first African-American to get a PhD in chemistry, but he certainly had a big impact at historically black colleges. What kind of things did he do?
He developed programs. He developed departments. He was instrumental in, I think they were called the Tally Lectures, which were named after one of his mentors at Fisk University, where he brought prominent scientists to Fisk to talk to the students. Essentially, he was well known for creating chemistry departments and creating really strong departments.
As an archivist, you found some letters that students wrote to him. What kind of things did people say to him?
So when he retired from Fisk, they reached out to all of his former students and they asked them to write letters. So his granddaughter had this massive binder full of letters. And in those letters, they all talk about he was a fantastic teacher, but mostly what they talk about is him mentoring them. One young man talks about how, because of St. Elmo Brady, he learned how to hold himself as a man, to present himself as a man. They discuss meeting him after class in his office and telling him their problems and just thanking him for listening to their problems, their youthful problems, as they put it. When he had research to do and other things to do, he took the time out to mentor them. So they mentioned that. They mentioned the mentoring, but they mostly just mentioned that he was a great teacher.
Shemetris Rimkus, she's an archivist at the University of Illinois, and we're learning about the first African-American to ever get a doctorate in chemistry right here at the University of Illinois, St. Elmo Brady. Lloyd Mudjanja is also with us. Lloyd, so your title, I want to ask you about your title, because you're the Assistant Director of Graduate Diversity and Program Climate with the Chemistry Department at the university. What does that mean?
So the graduate diversity is mainly focused on the sort of recruitment of diverse scientists, and that involves graduate students and faculty as well. But on the climate side of things, we're now looking at the aspects on retention or aspects of graduate students or faculty satisfaction with the department. So right now, if we recruit African-American students, we need to be very intentional about creating that environment where they can actually succeed. So that's where the climate aspect comes through.
A lot of like the mentoring, like what St. Elmo Brady did 100 years ago.
Exactly.
And I wonder, as you hear about that, how important is that difference in a graduate student's life, particular when we're thinking about people who may be underrepresented or in the minority?
So it's very important to actually be very intentional about that, because not only, like I mentioned earlier, that the PhD in chemistry is very difficult, but creating that community for the graduate students is so important for them to share ideas, for them to feel at home while they are still doing their research. Sometimes some of the students are first-generation PhD students, so they have no one who's ever got a PhD. For me, I didn't have anyone who got a PhD. So having a community where you can learn the unspoken rules of graduate school can go a long way in making you feel like you can do it, you can succeed.
And Lloyd, as we've heard Jemetris tell us about St. Elmo Brady's story, I wonder, as you mentioned, you also have a PhD in chemistry. Right. How did you first get interested in his story?
Yeah, that's a good question. How I became interested? Well, I'm always very interested in learning about the black scientists. So when I heard about St. Elmo Brady, I was very excited to know that he actually got a PhD in chemistry. As a black student, for me, it shows us that we can do this. We can be resilient enough to do the things we love to do the science. That story for me of St. Elmo Brady is a testament that we are supposed to be here in the Department of Chemistry. We're supposed to be doing the chemistry. We're supposed to succeed and probably give back to our communities like what St. Elmo Brady did. After he finished his PhD, he goes back to HBCUs and give back and develop those chemistry programs. So that story for me is very powerful, to be resilient and also to be able to give back to our communities.
So with that in mind, Jane Matris, I wonder what's going to happen today at the U of I to honor St. Elmo Brady's life?
There's a huge program that the School of Chemical Sciences has created. They've brought in representatives from the HBCUs. They have students coming. There's a workshop on applying to graduate schools. It's going to be a great day to encourage students and help them learn how to succeed and apply to these programs and how to identify a good program for themselves and continue their education in chemistry and using St. Elmo Brady as that inspiration to do that, because he's an example of, as Lloyd said, we're supposed to be here and we don't always see people that look like us. So it's great to know that we've always been here and we've always been accepted, and the university has always nurtured us as students and encouraged us to grow. And so that's what this event is about.
I wonder what you all think in terms of so you have this sort of inspirational story, but then obviously there are really real challenges that you all face, I imagine, on a day-to-day basis. Lloyd, when you're thinking in particular of your world in the chemistry department in terms of recruitment and retention and successful graduation of students, what do you think are, I wonder what you think are the biggest challenges ahead as you think about what he was able to do 100 years ago, what you all are facing today in 2019?
I still think that some of the challenges that St. Elmo Brady faced back then are still present right now. So you are a minority in a department, right? And so I feel like the biggest challenge is that sense of feeling like you're supposed to be there when there's not a whole critical mass of people that look like you.
Or you're the only person.
Right, or you're the only person, right? So that can be very challenging, I feel like, for some of our students to know that they are capable, and also to feel like their intellect is not constantly challenged because of they themselves being the only person of color, right? So they're in a predominantly sort of white department, and they want to bring their best selves to research. And so I feel like that could be a challenge for someone to be constantly checking themselves in an environment like that. But stories like St. Elmo Brady then for me is something that we can lean on to show that resilience. Like you still can do it. You can still get a PhD and things like that. So yeah, there's still a lot of challenges. The solution and why I'm excited for what I do is creating a critical mass of African-American students in the department. That's why some of the events we have today includes really reaching out to the HBCUs that produce some of the most talented African-American chemists, bring them to Illinois.
For graduate school.
Right, exactly. And start thinking about how can we create these partnerships? How can we have something very mutual between our institutions that can maintain a diversity we need in the department where students can have a form of a community?
I wonder if you feel like these stories have kind of been lost and they're now, I don't know if these stories have ever been part of the U of I's history, like maybe not as big a place as other, as white scientists have been.
So yes, you're right. Actually, that's actually a good point. I think a lot of stories for minorities tend to be lost. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's only because we don't have that critical mass, but there are stories nevertheless. So what I've been doing actually of recent is going through all the records to find all the African-Americans who have graduated with a PhD in chemistry in the department and see what they are doing. And some of them are doing a lot of great things. And I feel like this is now giving us, St. Elmo Brady celebrations, giving us a chance to go back in history, start digging on these stories, get them out, and celebrate the successes of all our minority students, women, Native Americans, African Americans, and all of that. There's a lot of things or achievements that have happened that seem to be buried.
For me, I think of historical figures like St. Elmo Brady. Like, we've always known who the first African American to get a degree from the University of Illinois was, which is William Walter Smith. We know he got this degree, but then it occurred to me recently, I don't know what else he did. What happened to him after he graduated? And so if no one ever asks the question, we just go on with our everyday lives and keep doing what we do. And in the university archives, I spend a lot of time researching university history, and it's usually other people's questions, wanting to know about their grandparents, their grandfather, their mother, their aunt, you know, even themselves. But it's not very often that someone wants to know about this minority, right, or this woman. And so we have a list of people that we know about that the university has always said, this was the first person to do this. This was the first person to do that. But then I find myself wondering, what did they do after they graduated? Did they go into industry? St. Elmo had the opportunity to go into industry. He chose to teach.
And I'll add on to that. So on a program, as sort of the graduate assistant director, so when I put together events or lectures and things like that, we're now thinking very strategically about how to bring back our alumni of color. The more the current graduate students see people like themselves, the more they can believe they can stay and get their PhDs. And the more African-American PhDs we have, the more we can actually effect change in policies in higher education so that our higher education institution can be more inclusive. If we don't have more PhD scientists who sit on the table at these decision-making meetings, so we end up losing on those voices of minorities, and the system never changes.
And really honor, it sounds like, also the legacy of what St. Elmo Brady started in 1916.
That's right.
That's Lloyd Munjanja, the Assistant Director of Graduate Diversity and Program Climate. He's with the University of Illinois Chemistry Department. And I want to thank U of I archivist Jamitris Rimkus also for being with us. We'll have more information actually at our website about all of the events that are going to happen today in Urbana. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, we heard about Governor Pritzker's executive order that would have Illinois join the U.S. Climate Alliance, a group of states that want to commit to emissions goals set by the Paris Climate Agreement. In Illinois, we still have our own internal battles when it comes to climate change, not just along political lines, but philosophical ones as well. That's why we wanted to revisit this conversation that originally aired in December. Democrats are fairly unified in wanting to do something about climate change, but a Pew report found there's a huge divide between older Republicans and their younger counterparts. Younger voters are more likely to support pro-environment policies, and the same can be said for young evangelical voters, long a political powerhouse. Mira Subramanian wrote about this young crop of evangelicals fighting against climate change for Inside Climate Change News, and she's on the line with us now. Hi, Mira. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Diego Hernandez, a sophomore at Wheaton College who was profiled in Mira's piece, and Riley Balikian, a member of the National Steering Committee for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, a geophysicist at the Illinois State Geological Survey and a Wheaton grad. Diego and Riley, welcome to both of you as well.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Riley, from what I understand, you grew up as an evangelical and you're now a scientist by profession. You're also a member of the Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, or YECA. Can you tell us how you first became passionate about climate change?
It was something that as a kid, I didn't grow up necessarily talking about it or thinking about it much. There was a few formative episodes, I would say. I think one of them was I did an internship abroad in Ethiopia. And a lot of the people there, it's a very rural population, and their livelihood is very dependent upon the natural world. And so seeing that and seeing some of the difficulties that people were dealing with made me much more sensitive to the way that our livelihood is based on the natural world and the climate and the weather around us. And really it was just coming back after that. Wheaton College is a very supportive community in terms of exploring new things and talking about it with different faculty and different students. That was something that I kind of came too late. And actually, in geophysics, I also kind of came too late. And that was kind of in sync, that I was learning more about climate change and about some of the issues we're dealing with, and also developing professionally as a scientist and growing interested in that. They're about the same time period in my life.
Diego, you're a sophomore from Wheaton. You're originally from Texas. I wonder how your experience in your home state influenced your feelings about the environment.
Yeah, well, in Texas specifically, where I'm from and the demographic, climate change isn't really a big issue. Especially as a young conservative, climate change isn't necessarily an issue that we take not that big of a deal. But not until I came to Wheaton and I went back home, I got to see a lot of things, travel the state, and not until then did I start realizing that climate change should be focused on more, and that it's a much bigger issue than what conservatives are making it.
And so would you say, Diego, that your thoughts about that are reflective of the culture at Wheaton in general? People being concerned about climate change and wanting to work to fix it?
I do believe so. I'm also part of student government here at Wheaton College. So I'm one of the sophomore class presidents. And this last year, the student government actually voted on adding a new position to student government, which is the executive vice president of campus sustainability. That person's role specifically is focusing on addressing the climate or addressing the environmental issues on campus. So I do believe that it's this very, very strong position that Wheaton College students are taking.
And Diego, I wonder how you think that contrasts with your friends or family, or I'm even thinking of your home church back home in Texas.
I think it's actually a really good step that we're taking right now, because as a Christian and as believers, we're taught to take care of the earth. When the fall of man happened, he told them that your role is to take care of the earth. And I think that rule is something that God still wants us to follow. So I think that as Christians, it's our calling to make sure that we are taking care of the earth. So I think if you go back home to Texas and you ask anyone, they'll definitely agree. I think it's more of asking the people in office what they're doing about it.
That's Diego Hernandez, who's a sophomore at Wheaton College. We've also been speaking with Riley Balikian, a member of the YECA National Steering Committee and a geophysicist at Illinois State Geological Survey in Central Illinois. We found out about them from Mira Subramanian. She's a reporter for Insight Climate News. We'll tweet out Mira's story about this. But Mira, do you, these sentiments, what Diego and Riley are telling us, does that echo what you found in your reporting when it comes to younger generations of Christians, particularly evangelical Christians?
That's definitely what I found at Wheaton College, and this is kind of a place where this action is really coming from in some regards, in terms of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, started out of this area and is expanding across the nation, and so it's still a growing body. I mean, I think I would have found a different story if I'd gone to Bob Jones University, for example, because there is that political affiliation that is such a strong indicator of how people stand on climate change. It actually is, the political affiliation is actually a stronger indicator of what people think about it than religion is.
Riley, I wonder how, as a scientist, your faith informs your science?
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are Christians and scientists will say, and I agree, that the very basics of science is based in Christian thinking, that there's a logic to the world, that there's a creator who is intelligent and we can interpret the world intelligently. I think love for the creation and a moral response, it's not just studying the science, but it's studying the nature. It's a love and a care for the nature that I think informs a lot of my work. I think that, in a lot of ways, a curiosity about things, that's, I think, also something that we get an inspiration of curiosity and wonderment about the world. And I think that for me is coming from my faith. I know other people can get that from other places as well, and that's a large part of the scientific community. But for me, that's very much based in my faith, wanting to know more about God, the creator, as well as God in creation.
And when you guys think about that, Riley and Diego, I wonder, to Mira's point, do you feel like sometimes when you're thinking in evangelical circles, the politics can color that? I wonder how you all manage to overcome maybe political objections to all of this. Diego?
I do think that the politics of certain people's politics may have a role in altering what their opinion might be. I think it's not necessary. I mean, I think conversation has a very, very important role in determining how people view their a new way of thinking about climate change. But when I was talking with Mira, what basically made me start feeling convicted about how we're treating the climate was when I took a trip to the coastal area of Texas, and my mom wanted to take me on the scenic route. And when she took me on the scenic route, it was basically nothing but oil fields, and there was drills everywhere. And I think what basically has to get not only talked about, but also seen by people is that the environment is being affected in many other ways than one. It's not just the fact that we're, you know, drilling everywhere, and people say, oh, well, we're drilling offshore, which is not always true. In many cases, we're drilling on land and pretty far inland. I think that not only do we need to be talking about it, but we need to be showing people the causes or the effects of what's going on.
Well, I would just say that in addition to political ideology, I don't know that it's fair to necessarily put all Christians or even all evangelicals in one political camp. I think it's almost a philosophical difference, might be a better way of thinking about it. For Christians, and especially evangelical Christians, and I would include myself in this, the scripture is the ultimate source of truth. And so when you're looking at other truth systems and the claims that they make around the world, whether that's about climate science or, you know, one of the more contentious things has been the origins debate, a lot of that is filtered through how do we understand the world as given to us through scripture. And so, you know, scripture doesn't speak a lot on climate science, so there's probably there may be some politics playing in there as well. But I think for most people, their understanding of the world, for most evangelical Christians, I should say, their understanding of the world is filtered through the lens of scripture.
Mira, I wanted to ask you about something else that you wrote about, which was the idea of pro-life. And the way that you have an interpretation that I think people may not think of when it comes to the environment. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is really interesting that I was just hearing from younger voices, is that there's a whole idea of like a larger idea of intersectionality and social justice issues and how the impacts of climate change are playing out. And that's actually interesting, going to Riley's point of like going back to scripture, is like the idea of caring for the least of these, you know, in the biblical times was widows and orphans. And now places like the National Evangelical Association, which is a huge association that represents like 43 million American evangelicals, they've put out a statement in 2015 saying they accept climate change, they accept that it's human caused, and that there should be action taken. And their argument, the fundamental argument behind the reason to take action, is that the people that will be impacted are the people that Riley met in Ethiopia, people who are really vulnerable, who are very, very dependent on the natural resources and the state of, you know, they need farmland that can produce, that gets enough water, that doesn't get too much water, and they need fisheries that their livelihoods depend on. So this whole idea of social justice behind it is something that I was really hearing. And so that extends to the pro-life, I think, because the abortion issue has become such a single vote issue for many evangelical Americans. What I heard from many of the students at Wheaton was like, we're thinking about pro-life at all stages of human life. And we're talking about not just the existence of a life, but the quality of that life, that they have the ability to make a living, to make a healthy living, that their children can grow up to be healthy and have opportunities. And so a much, much broader expansion of what it means to be pro-life.
Mira, that said, I wonder if you see climate change becoming maybe a wedge voter issue for young evangelicals. Could that change the way people are voting?
I think that it could. I mean, I just see so much more, like those statistics that you were referencing in the beginning of the show about just young people. The reality is that this is going to be their problem more than, you know, I'm in my middle ages and there's people that are older that are in control. And the reality is that the future is going to be a long haul in terms of how these issues are going to play out. And so I think that those Pew polls are reflecting that younger people are more concerned about it. And so I actually do think that it could very much become a wedge issue. And I don't know, you know, for the Christian right that is concerned about abortion issues, I don't know that the Democratic Party is ever going to adjust their stance on that. But I could see the Republicans, given enough pressure, or young people just being engaged and voting, because they are an amazing political powerhouse, young Americans, if they get out to the polls. I think that they could help influence the Republican Party to perhaps be more active on climate action. And it doesn't have to come from a earthy place. It can come from an economic standpoint, places like Texas that are embracing wind power because it's a good moneymaker. There's jobs and good economic security in heading in that direction as well. So it could become a wedge issue, I believe.
Diego, what about you? I know you weren't old enough to vote in the last presidential election, but how important is climate change and the environment when you're thinking about 2020 or other elected, whether not just president, but other elected officials?
Yeah, it's definitely become a big issue for me. For someone who hasn't grown up and who hasn't been studying climate change for a decent portion of my life or while I'm in college, it's still a pretty new issue to me. So I'm always trying to learn as much as I can. But definitely seeing what I've seen, hearing, talking with students on campus and talking with Mira, just diving into the issue a lot more, it's definitely becoming a bigger issue for me. And I also believe it's becoming a much bigger issue for students on campus and for young evangelicals. So I really do think that come next election, climate change will be a much bigger issue that's going to be focused on, especially in young people.
And Riley, apart from voting, I mentioned at the beginning that your work with the Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, what kind of things are you guys working on in the near future when it comes to realistic things that individuals can do?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit biased, but I think we have one of the best young leadership development programs I've seen. And that's we have a program called the Climate Leadership Fellows, and these are mostly students, but it's just a, you know, whoever fits within the young evangelical framework within their communities doing specific projects to make towards sustainability. And so we have some students that or some young people who are doing recycling programs at their school where there wasn't one before. There's some students that are working in food sustainability. The sustainability student government person that Diego mentioned at Wheaton, that was in part work done by one of our fellows that kind of helped that come about. There's a lot of young people who are doing things in their local communities that's really inspiring, and it's one of the favorite things about my work that I do with YECA is to see the work that they're doing and the ways that they're growing as young leaders in their communities.
And are you expecting to see that happen in churches as well?
Yeah, we also, there have been a few fellows that have been doing work in their churches. It's not as common. I think it's a little bit more, it's a little bit different dynamic trying to work in the churches. I don't think it's impossible. We have another program called the Project Leaders, which is very similar, but just structured a little different. And we've had a couple people who have done Bible studies that are based on what does it look like to care for creation? What does it look like to be made in the image of God and to be living that out in the way that we are interacting with the world around us. And so there is action in the churches. There's actions a lot of times at the colleges, whether they're Christian colleges or, you know, public colleges. But I think there's a lot of encouraging work being done by our organization and by other organizations as well, and other students who just are inspired to act on climate.
That's Riley Bilikian, who's a member of the YECAs. We've been talking about Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. He's on the National Steering Committee. He's also a geophysicist at Illinois State Geological Survey and a Wheaton College grad. I want to thank current Wheaton student sophomore Diego Hernandez and Mira Subramanian, the journalist who wrote about evangelicals and climate change for Insight Climate News, will tweet out Mira's story. But all of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Coming up after the break, an Illinois documentary has been nominated for an Oscar. We'll revisit our conversation with Bing Liu, director of the film Minding the Gap, set in Rockford. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. An Illinois documentary has been getting lots of notice at film festivals around the world, including Sundance, where it won a special jury award. Now, the film, called Minding the Gap, has been nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. The film follows the lives of three young skateboarders in Rockford and the family they form skating, which helped them cope with abuse, death, and domestic violence.
Take one.
I'm making this film because I saw myself in your story.
I always felt like I didn't fit in with my family.
My parents ran this very controlling house. I ran away a lot.
Skateboarding is more of a family than my family.
Back in August, we sat down with filmmaker Bing Liu. He's the producer and director of Minding the Gap, and he joined us from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Hi, Bing. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Bing, I know you're behind the camera, but this is very much your story, too. I wanted to just to start by asking, where did you first meet the other two guys in the film?
When I was a sophomore or junior in high school, that was when the first public skate park opened up in Rockford, Illinois. So I went there, and one of the guys who's one of the main characters is Zach. He's a couple years younger than me. And he went to a different high school, but that's where I met him. And he was a really good skateboarder, so I filmed him as part of the, you know, part of the wider community of skateboarders that I was filming. We didn't hang out that much outside of the skate park, and after a few years, I left town. But when I came back to Rockford to make the film, you know, I reconnected with him because he was about to become a father himself. And then with Kier, he's much younger. He's 7 or 8 years younger than me, and so I caught him, you know, as a little kid at the skate park on video a couple times, but I didn't really get to know him that well until I came back to make the film.
And when did you start skateboarding? When you were in middle school?
Yeah, I think I was like 12 or 13.
And I've never skateboarded, but there are these beautiful scenes of the guys skateboarding together down the street and around the skate park. It looks like a flock of birds flying. Is that how it feels to skateboard, like flying?
Yeah, it feels, you know, I was just talking about this with someone today. You know, it's actually much more like ballet or dancing than it is like something, you know, aggressive, which is the way that I think sometimes it gets portrayed.
And how did you shoot those scenes? Because there's a lot of scenes of you following the guys. Are you on a skateboard as well?
Most of the time I'm running on foot. I'd been working, as you know, in the camera department on movies and TV shows for a long time, and I worked with a lot of Steadicam operators, and I saw that as, you know, a great way to capture skateboarding. So I just used a sort of a poor man's Steadicam called the Glide Cam. I was able to run behind them. So yeah, I really wanted to capture a fresh way of, I really wanted to shoot skateboarding in a way that translated, you know, the sort of emotional, like human side of it, rather than this focus on the tricks. And so I trained for a year or two to really get to the point where I was intuitive using the Glide Cam, running on foot to follow skateboarding.
You trained for a year before you started shooting?
Yeah, I mean, when I say train, I mean, you know, I was just experimenting with shooting skateboarding, like, outside of doing Mine in the Gap with this Glide Cam. So, you know, the first few months, it was pretty rocky, but I eventually got better and better at it. And so by the time I shot Mine in the Gap, you know, I felt really comfortable with that tool.
So there is, to the point that you made about emotion, there's this really delicate, I think very respectful balance that you achieve in a way I haven't often seen between these subjects who are your friends, but also maintaining both their story and your story. Was that something you thought a lot about?
I think it started when I was growing up. You know, I felt like I was a pseudo-therapist for a lot of my friends. It's just sort of what helped me get through my childhood. And so by the time I dug into Zach and Kiara's lives, you know, it felt pretty natural.
And so I think when we're thinking about this, there's a lot of this story where there's a lot of different things, both when you're talking about you, but also with Zach. And you mentioned before fatherhood. I think fatherhood's a really important part of this story. And there are scenes of the guys at the skate park holding Zach's baby and taking care of him. And I feel like we don't often get to see the perspective of really young fathers like we do with teenage moms. Is that part of why you wanted to include that?
I mean, when I first started the project, I really wanted to look at intergenerational growth. And, you know, I felt like there was a lot happening with, you know, young men either modeling their fathers or, you know, going against what their fathers represented if the relationship wasn't healthy. So that was something I really wanted to dig into. And that's partly why, you know, in documentary, it's all about access and casting. That's often what makes for a great film. And so, you know, Zach and Keir were people that I found after a year of traveling around the country, looking for people to follow. And Zach just really, you know, his charisma just really screams off the screen. You really want to watch him. But also, he was about to become a father, and that was not something I'd found with other skateboarders I was looking at.
Some of the really wrenching scenes revolve around Kier and the death of his father and how hard it was for him to handle. Kier says at one point that taking part in this documentary with you was like free therapy. Was that true for you as well?
Not in making the film. I mean, for me, you know, I was a one-man band for most of the production besides this one scene where I hired a sound person and a camera person to film me filming. So for me, it was like, you know, I was just caught up in the nitty-gritty of making the film. You know, what do I need to film next? You know, when, you know, I have to have this rough cut ready for this feedback screening, you know, in a few months, let me focus on that. You know, where's Kier going to be at on this day when I have time to go out to Rockford? So I was very much caught up in the making of the film, and there wasn't anybody pressing back on me in the way that I was pressing on Zach and Kier to really try to dig into the past and what it meant.
Mm. There is this thread of abuse. And as you're talking about sort of the difficult stories, there's abuse by fathers and stepfathers. And it also, I think it's very interesting how this cuts across all the racial lines of the film, whether it's African-American or Asian or white. When we're thinking about that part of the story, how hard was that something you were looking for in particular, or is that something that came out as you were filming?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really the point of making the film. I mean, the skateboarding, I mean, if you add up the numbers, it's probably only like 10 or 15 minutes of actual skateboarding in the film. It's really a coming of age film that really looks at violence in the home and where it comes from and, you know, how it affects boys who grow up. So skateboarding always felt like the sugar that was, you know, added to the spoonful of medicine. So that's, it was pretty, you know, it was just sort of finding a way to get at it in a way that I hadn't seen before.
And there's a connection that you, a point that you make, you talk about statistics and you talk about statistics in Rockford and you mentioned the role that domestic violence plays in violent crime statistics. Was that also another way for you to be, for us to be thinking about domestic violence?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I feel like domestic violence as a subject, even hearing the word, can really conjure up sort of, you know, media or studies or, you know, discussions in the classroom maybe that are really on the nose. And I feel like, you know, having experienced it and witnessed it myself personally, it's not really, it doesn't really quite get at the experience of living through it. You know, I think the experience of living through it is that it's just an aspect of your life as you grow up and it's there, it's ever present, but it's not this dreary, dark thing all the time. I mean, you still have these moments of elation and joy. You still have, you know, these feelings of love and hope. And so, you know, I was trying to find a way to tackle the experience of domestic violence in a way that wasn't too on the nose, that just felt like this, you know, something in the ether of their lives. And so things like filming the billboards that are in the film or things like including, you know, the couple snippets of statistics were ways that I felt comfortable doing that.
I also think that there is this really, you said, you mentioned it before, the scene where you confront your mom, and this is where you were saying you had hired someone, about the abuse that you suffered at the hands of her husband, your stepfather. And she says she wishes that she was stronger and she doesn't know what to say to you. And I wonder if you think part of what keeps the cycle of abuse going is when people don't talk about things.
Yeah, that's certainly the start of it. I mean, it's just brushed behind closed doors. That's a big factor. I think there's a lot of factors that figure into why the cycle keeps spinning. There's not a lot of, you know, common language that we have to be able to talk about it without, like, this, you know, shameful look down at the floor sort of feeling that glosses over those conversations. So,
well, and it's nuanced, as you said, right? Because it's really complicated, because these aren't relationships where it is all about the violence or the anger. And you see that through the relationships that are in the dock, the way that people relate to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I want to complicate the narrative. I mean, it's not just like good person, good behavior, bad behavior. It's so tied into just the whole melange of feelings, the complicated situations that life brings up, you know, the way that we make mistakes and grow. I mean, it's all part of it.
Bing, so you're from Beijing and you grew up in Rockford. How did you end up wanting to become a filmmaker?
I think it was just, you know, I get obsessed with stuff. My folks are from the southwest of China in Sichuan, and I was sort of shipped around a lot to different folks because my parents were going to school in different cities at the time. And then when we moved to the States, we actually moved to Alabama, and my mom and dad divorced, and I was just left home alone a lot. And I was 5. And then we moved to LA, and it was like more time sort of being a latchkey kid. So I escaped to my imagination a lot. I watched a lot of movies and played with a bunch of toys and, you know, got obsessed with certain things. I think skateboarding became an obsession when I first started doing it. And then when I first picked up a camera, I was 14, I became obsessed with that too. It became this way to create new realities. And then I went to school to become an English teacher, actually, majored in literature. And then while I was in school, I just got a production assistant job. And little did I know, for the next 10 years, I would just be working as a freelance filmmaker.
This was produced with Cartemquin Films here. What was it like to also shoot this in Illinois and produce it here as well?
Felt really nice. I mean, I'd worked as a crew member on productions in New York and LA, and it's just, you know, such a different vibe on the coasts. I think there's something very special about working in the Midwest. There's so much like cultural richness, and there's so much, I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's something that just I really like about the Midwest. And it was really awesome working with Cartemquin because, you know, they're this award-winning production company that really feels more like a community than a company. I mean, they're housed in this old apartment that the founder bought in the 70s. You know, and if you end up editing in one of their edit suites, it's like, you know, you're sitting on a roller chair. And if you let go, your roller chair slowly starts just rolling towards a wall. I mean, it's just got that sort of character to it. And everybody that works there, you know, works there for the love. There's something really wholesome and nice about being a Midwest filmmaker.
And I wonder what it's like also now to be a Midwest filmmaker and have venues like Amazon or Netflix, or in your case, Hulu, to help produce these docs or films. Does that make it easier?
Well, Hulu didn't acquire it until after Sundance, but it definitely feels nice to have the audience reach that these platforms provide. I think it's, you know, I think in the 2000s the film industry became a little bit more democratic with cheaper equipment, but now with streaming platforms, you know, there's a more democratic sort of audience reach as well. I'm really happy that Hulu, you know, liked the film enough to pick it up. And I'm really excited because they have a really young audience. And I'm already seeing like the comments flow in from the trailer.
So Hulu picked it up afterwards. Were you surprised by that?
You know, everything's been a surprise. Getting into Sundance has been a surprise. I mean, this has been a crazy, crazy ride.
That's producer and director Bing Liu. We spoke with him back in August. His film, Minding the Gap, has been nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary Feature category. We wish him the best of luck. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting live from the Illini Center in downtown Chicago, and we're going to hear from WBEZ's Dave McKinney about his new podcast. It's called Public Official A, and it tells the story of one of our state's most infamous governors, Rod Blagojevich. By the way, we've introduced a new way for you to interact with us. It's called Ask the 21st, and it's a place for you to ask questions you'd like us to research. We did this before the inauguration of J.B. Pritzker. We enjoyed seeing your questions about the new administration in Springfield. Now, we're curious what questions you might have for Washington. We're going to be broadcasting from D.C. next week from NPR headquarters. Leave us a question about Washington, about the federal government, any questions you have about D.C. by going to askthe21st.org. And we'll try to answer it maybe even this week ahead of our trip. Again, that website is askthe21st.org. There are lots of ways to connect with us and listen to past shows. One of them is the NPR One app. It's pretty simple to download, set your home station. And if you search for the 21st to follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. But we're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, we've got the latest in Illinois news for you. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. Again, 21stshow.org, and that's got links for everything. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.